she was making introductions when I took my seat next to Jennifer at the defense table. "Did you ask Maggie McPherson to be here?" I whispered. "Yes, I did," Jennifer said. "Why would you do that?" "Because she's a prosecutor, and if she says you won't flee, then that will carry a lot of weight with the judge. Also a lot of weight with her bosses. You shouldn't have put that kind of pressure on. Mickey, my job today is to get you out of jail. I'll use every tool I can get my hands on, and you would too." Before I could respond, Deputy Chan called the courtroom to order. A second later, Judge Warfield stepped through the door behind the clerk's station and moved quickly up the steps to the bench. "Back on the record in California versus Holler," she began. "We have a motion to reduce bail. Who will be arguing for the defense?"
"I will,"
Jennifer said, standing at the defense table. "Very well, Miss Aronson," Warfield said. "I have the motion before me. Do you have further argument before we hear from the people?" Jennifer moved to the lectern, with a legal pad and a stack of documents to distribute.
"Yes, Your Honor," she said. "In addition to the cases mentioned in the moving papers, I have additional case law here that supports the motion for a lower bail. This is not charged as a case with extenuating or aggravating circumstances, and at no time has the state even hinted at an argument that Mr. Holler is a risk to the community. As far as being a flight risk, he has shown nothing since his arrest except the absolute intention to fight this charge and exonerate himself, despite this baseless attempt to hamper his pro se defense by keeping him locked up and unable to fully prepare his case. Put simply, the prosecution wants to keep Mr. Holler in jail because they are afraid and want to go to trial on a slanted playing field." The judge waited a beat in case there was more. Berg stood up at her spot at the prosecution table and waited to be recognized. "Additionally, Your Honor," Jennifer said, "I do have a number of witnesses here who are willing to testify, if need be, to the character of Mr. Holler."
"I'm sure that will not be necessary," Warfield said. "Ms. Berg, I see you are waiting to respond." Berg moved to the lectern as Jennifer vacated it.
"Thank you, Judge Warfield," she said. "The state opposes lowering bail in this matter because the defendant does have the means and motive to flee. As the court well knows, we are talking about a murder here, the victim of which was found in the trunk of the defendant's car, and the evidence clearly indicates the murder took place in the defendant's garage. In fact, Your Honor, the evidence in this case is overwhelming, and this gives the defendant all the reason in the world to flee."
Jennifer objected to Berg's characterization of the evidence and her presuming what my state of mind would be. The judge instructed Berg to refrain from such speculation and to continue.
"Additionally, Your Honor," Berg said, "the state is considering adding a special circumstance allegation to the charge in this case, which would render the question of bail moot."
Jennifer shot up out of her seat.
"Objection!" she exclaimed.
I knew this was the battle line. An allegation of special circumstances, murder for hire or for financial gain, would bump the charge to the no-bail level.
"Counsel's argument is preposterous," Jennifer protested. "Not only is there no special circumstance that could be applied in this case, but the defense motion was filed last week. And if the state was considering a valid special circumstance allegation, it would have added it by now. The state is blowing smoke, hoping to stop the court from providing Mr. Holler's right to bail."
Warfield's eyes moved from Jennifer to Berg.
"Defense counsel makes a good argument," the judge said. "What is the special circumstance allegation the state is supposedly considering?"
"Your Honor, the investigation of this crime is ongoing, and we are developing evidence of a financial motive," Berg said. "And as the court well knows, murder for financial gain is a special circumstance crime." Jennifer angrily spread her hands wide. Your Honor, she said, is the district attorney's office really asking for bail to be set on the basis of what evidence might be found down the line? This is incredible.
Incredible or not, this court is not going to consider what may lie in the future while making rulings in the present, Warfield said. Do both sides submit?
Submitted, Jennifer said.
One moment, Your Honor,
Berg said. I watched her lean down to confer with her second, a young attorney who wore bow ties. I had a pretty good idea what they were talking about. Warfield quickly grew impatient.
Ms. Berg, you asked for time to prepare for this hearing, and I gave it. There should be no need for a sidebar with your colleague. Are you ready to submit?
Berg straightened up and looked at the judge.
No, Your Honor, she said. The state believes that the court should be made aware that there is an ongoing investigation of the defendant relating to a plan to flee the country to Mexico, should he be released on bail.
Jennifer stood up.
Your Honor, she protested. More unfounded allegations? Is the state so desperate to keep this man in jail that it trumps up an investigation into...
Your Honor, I said as I stood up. If I may address this allegation.
In a moment, Mr. Holler, Warfield said. Ms. Berg, this better be good. Tell me more about this alleged plan to flee the country.
Judge, all I know is that a confidential informant in the jail where Mr. Holler is being housed revealed to investigators that the defendant has openly spoken about a plan to cross the border and flee if he can make bail. The plan includes circumventing an electronic monitor should the court order that as part of a bail reduction, and co-counsel is fully aware of this. The defendant has gone so far as to invite her down to go fishing.
What do you say about that, Mr. Holler? Warfield asked.
Your Honor, the prosecution's claim is false on multiple levels, starting with the alleged confidential informant, I said. There is no CI. There are only the jail deputies listening in on privileged conversations and then feeding what they hear to the prosecution as intel.
That's a serious allegation, Mr. Holler, Warfield said. Do you care to enlighten us with your knowledge?
The judge gestured toward the lectern, and I stepped over.
Judge Warfield, thank you for the opportunity to bring this matter before the court, I began. I've been incarcerated at Twin Towers for 6 weeks. I elected to go pro se and defend myself with the help of my co-counsel, Miss Aronson. This meant meetings with my team in the jail, as well as calls from the community phones in the K-10 module. These meetings and calls are not supposed to be monitored in any way by law enforcement or anyone else. The privilege is supposed to be sacrosanct.
I hope you're going to get to a point soon, Mr. Holler, the judge interjected.
Arriving there now, Your Honor, I responded. As I said, the privilege is sacrosanct. But I became suspicious that that was not the case at Twin Towers, and that somehow what was said in my meetings and phone calls with co-counsel and my investigator was getting back to the DA's office and Ms. Berg. And so, Your Honor, I set up a little test to either prove or disprove my theory. On a phone call with my co-counsel, I announced that I was having a call with counsel under privilege and stated that the call should not be monitored. But it was, and I spun a story that just came out of Miss Berg's mouth almost verbatim. Berg stood to speak, and I gestured with my hand as if to say, "Your turn." I wanted her to respond because I would then hang her with her own words.
Your Honor, Berg began, talk about incredible. The defense's plan to flee is revealed in court, and his response is to say, yes, but I was just kidding. I was just testing to see if anyone was listening. That's a confirmation, Your Honor, and reason alone not to reduce bail in this matter, but to raise it.
Does this mean that counsel for the people acknowledges listening to the privileged call? I asked.
It means no such thing,
Berg shot back.
Excuse me,
the judge boomed.
I'm the judge here, and I'll ask the questions if you don't mind.
She paused and stared down hard, first at me and then at Berg.
When exactly was this call, Mr. Holler?
She asked. About 5:40 p.m. Thursday, I responded. Warfield shifted her focus to Berg.
I would like to hear this phone call, she said. Is that possible, Ms. Berg?
No, Your Honor, Berg said. Privileged calls are destroyed by the monitors because they are privileged.
Destroyed after they are listened to?
The judge pressed.
No, Your Honor, Berg said. Privileged calls are privileged. They are not listened to once they are established as protected conversations with counsel or others under the rules of privilege. The calls are then destroyed. That is why it is not possible to confirm or refute counsel's outlandish allegation, and he knows it.
That's wrong, Your Honor, I said. Warfield swung her eyes back to me and squinted them down to slots.
What are you saying, Mr. Holler? She asked.
I'm saying we were running a test, I said. Miss Aronson recorded the call, and that recording is available to the court right now. The air momentarily went out of the room while Berg recalculated.
Your Honor, I am going to object to any playing of a tape, she said. There is no way to validate its legitimacy.
I disagree, Judge, I said. The tape begins with the jail system's collect call announcement, and more importantly, you will hear the exact words and story Ms. Berg just revealed to the court. Now, if I were to make a phony tape, how would I know exactly what she was going to say in court?
Warfield registered that for a few moments before responding.
Let's hear the tape, she said.
Your Honor, Berg said, panic creeping into her voice.
The people objection overruled, Warfield said. I said, let's hear the tape.
Jennifer came forward with her cell phone, placed it on the lectern, and bent the stem microphone down to it before pushing the play button on the recording app. Without my instruction, Jennifer had been smart enough to record the call from the start, including the electronic voice saying she was receiving a collect call from the LA County Jail. After the call was over, she had also added her own tag, announcing that the call had been a test to see if LA County authorities were violating my privilege rights. The call was convincing. I wanted to see Berg's reaction, but could not pull my eyes away from the judge. Her face seemed to grow darker as she heard the parts of the conversation that Berg had said came from an informant. When the tape ended with Jennifer's tag, I asked the judge if she wished to hear it again. She said no, then took a moment to compose herself and her verbal response. As a former defense attorney, she'd probably always had reason to be suspicious about the monitoring of calls from jailed clients to their lawyers.
May I address the court? Berg said. I did not listen to that call. What I represented to the court earlier was the truth as it was told to me. The sheriff's jail intelligence unit provided a report that gave me the information and said it came from an informant. I did not knowingly lie to or mislead the court.
Whether or not I believe you doesn't matter, Warfield said. A serious intrusion upon the rights of this defendant has occurred, and there are consequences for that. There will be an investigation, and the truth will come out. In the meantime, I'm ready to rule on the defense motion on bail. Any other argument, Ms. Berg?
No, Your Honor, Berg said.
I didn't think so, the judge said.
May I be heard, Your Honor? I asked.
There is no need, Mr. Haller. No need.
Chapter 12. A small group of friends, colleagues, and loved ones were there to greet me when I stepped through the inmate release door at Twin Towers. They erupted in cheers and applause as I came through. The media was there too, and they filmed me as I went down the line, hugging and handshaking. It was embarrassing, but felt good at the same time. I was breathing free air again, and wanted to revel in it. One of my Lincolns was there at the curb, ready to go. Obviously, not the one Sam Scales had been murdered in. Harry Bosch and André Lacasse were last in the well-wishers' line. I thanked them both for being willing to stand up for me and put up their money as well.
We got off cheap, Bosch said.
You played that perfectly in court, Lacasse added, as usual.
Well, I said, $25K apiece is still a lot of money in my book, and I will pay you guys back sooner than you think. Both men had generously agreed to put up as much as $200,000 each to pay for a 10% bond. But Judge Warfield was so enraged by the obvious eavesdropping on my jail calls that she dropped bail from $5 million to $500,000 as punishment for the wrongdoing. Unfortunately, she also ordered me to wear an ankle monitor, but this did not dampen the news that my two sponsors only had to put up a fraction of what they had offered. It was a good day all round. I was free. I took André aside for a private moment.
André, you didn't need to do this, man, I said.
I mean, Harry's my brother, there's blood there, but you're a client. And I hate like hell taking any of the money you earned with your own blood.
Yes, I did, he said. I had to do it. I wanted to do it.
I nodded my thanks again and shook his hand. As I did so, Fernando Valenzuela walked up. He had missed the cheering section.
So, don't burn me on this, Haller, he said.
Val, my man, I said. We bumped fists.
When I first heard that shit in court about Mexico, I thought, what the fuck? Valenzuela said. But then, man, you had it wired. Good show.
Ain't no show, Val, I said. I had to get out. And now you are. I'll be monitoring you.
I'm sure you will.
Valenzuela moved off, and the others crowded around me again. I looked for Maggie, but didn't see her. Lorna asked what I wanted to do.
Meet with the team? Be by yourself? What?
She asked.
You know what I want? I said. I want to get in that Lincoln, open all the windows, and just drive out to the beach.
Can I go?
Haley asked.
Me too?
Kendall added.
Of course, I said. Who's got my keys?
Lorna put the keys into my hand. Then she handed me a phone.
The police still have yours, she said. But we think we have all your contacts and email on this.
Perfect, I said. Then I leaned down and whispered to her.
Let's get the team together later, I said.
Call Christian at Dantana's and see if we can get in. I've been eating bologna for 6 weeks. Tonight I want steak.
You got it, Lorna said.
And ask Harry to come, I added. Maybe he's had a chance to look at the discovery file, and we'll have something to say.
Will do.
One other thing. Did you talk to Maggie in court? She kind of disappeared, and I'm wondering if she's pissed off at us for bringing her there as a character witness.
No, she's not mad. Once the judge said she didn't need any testimonials, she told me she had to get back to work, but she was there for you.
I nodded. It was good to know. I unlocked the Lincoln with the remote and walked around to the driver's side.
Fall in, ladies, I said.
Kendall gave up the front seat to Haley and took the back. That was nice of her, and I smiled at her in the rear view.
Eyes on the road, Dad, Haley said.
Right, I said. We pulled away from the curb. I worked my way down to the 10 freeway and headed west.
At that point, it was time to put up the windows so we could hear one another talk.
How do you feel? Kendall asked.
Pretty good for a guy still charged with murder, I said.
But you're going to win, right, Dad?
Haley asked urgently.
Don't worry, Hay. I'm going to win, I said.
And that's when I'll go from feeling pretty good to feeling pretty great, okay?
Okay, she said.
We rode in silence for a few moments.
Can I ask a dumb question? Kendall said.
There are no dumb questions when it comes to the law, I said. Only dumb answers.
What happens next? She said.
Now that you're out on bail, will the trial get delayed?
I won't let them delay it, I said.
I have them on speedy trial.
What exactly does that mean? Kendall asked.
I looked over at my daughter.
You're 1L, I said. Why don't you answer that?
I only know the answer because of you, not law school, Haley said.
She turned to look back over the seat at Kendall.
If you're accused of a crime, you're entitled to a speedy trial, she said. In California, that means they have 10 court days from your arrest to hold a preliminary hearing or seek an indictment from a grand jury. Either way, you then get formally arraigned on the charges and the state must take you to trial within 60 calendar days or drop the charges and dismiss the case.
I nodded. She had it right.
What are calendar days? Kendall asked.
That just means work days, Haley said.
It's 60 days excluding weekends and holidays. My father was indicted and arraigned right before Thanksgiving, November 12th, to be exact, and the 60 days push us into February. They count 2 days at Thanksgiving and a whole week from Christmas to New Year's as holidays. Then you add in Martin Luther King Day and President's Day when the courts are closed. It all adds up to February 18th.
D-Day, I said.
I reached over and squeezed Haley's knee, like the proud father I was. The traffic was flowing, and I took the freeway all the way to the curving tunnel that dumped out onto the Pacific Coast Highway. I pulled into a lot that served one of the beach clubs down there and got out. An attendant came walking toward us. I reached into my pocket but realized all the belongings from my pockets the night I was arrested were in an envelope I had handed off to Lorna so I could shake hands and hug people.
I don't have any money, I said.
Either of you have a five we can give this guy for 10 minutes on the beach?
I got it,
Kendall said. She paid the man, and we all walked across the pedestrian and bike paths and across the sand toward the water. Kendall took off her heels and carried them in one hand. There was something very sexy about her doing that.
Dad, you're not going to jump in, right?
Haley asked.
Nah,
I said. I just want to hear the waves. Everything sounds like echoes and iron where I've been. I need to wash it out of my ears with something good. We stopped on a berm that was just above the wet sand where the surf washed in. The sun was slinking down toward the blue-black water. I held both my companion's hands and said nothing. I breathed deeply and thought about where I had been. I resolved at that moment that I had to win the case because there was no way I was going back into lockup. I would take all extreme alternatives to that. I let go of Haley's hand and then pulled her close.
Oh, this is about me, I said. How are you doing, Hay?
I'm good, she said. What you told me about first year being a bitch is true.
Yeah, but you're smarter than I ever was. You'll do fine.
We'll see. How's your mom? I saw her in court, and Jennifer said she was going to vouch for me if needed.
She's good. And yeah, she was ready to speak up for you.
I'll call her and thank her.
That would be nice.
I turned and looked at Kendall. It almost felt like she had never left me for Hawaii.
And you?
I said.
You doing all right?
I am now, she said. I didn't like seeing you in the courtroom.
I nodded. I got that.
I looked out at the ocean. The pounding of the waves seemed to echo in my chest. The colors were vibrant, not the gray of my last 6 weeks.
It was beautiful and I didn't want to leave. Okay, I finally said. Time's up. Back to work.
The traffic was not as kind heading in the opposite direction. It took almost an hour to get Haley to her apartment in K-Town after she turned down my invitation to dinner in favor of her weekly study group. This week's subject, the rule against perpetuities. After dropping her off, I stayed on the curb and called Lorna. She told me that dinner was set up at Dantana's at 8 p.m. and that Harry Bosch would be in attendance. I think he has something to discuss, Lorna said.
Good, I said. I want to hear it.
I disconnected and looked at Kendall.
So, I said,
the dinner with my team is at 8, and it sounds like they really want to work and discuss the case. I don't think...
That's okay, she said.
I know you want to get to it. You can just drop me off.
Where?
Well, I took you up on your offer. I've been at your place. Is that okay?
Of course. I forgot, but that's great. I want to go there anyway to change. This is the suit I was arrested in. It doesn't fit me anymore, and it smells like jail to me.
Good, then. You'll be taking off your clothes.
I looked at her, and she smiled provocatively. I thought we were broken up, I said.
We are, she said. That's why this is going to be so much fun.
Really?
Really?
Okay, then. I pulled the Lincoln away from the curb.
Chapter 13. Somebody once said that a person's favorite restaurant is where they know you. That might be true. They knew me at Dantana's, and I knew them. Christian at the door, Arturo at the table, Mike behind the bar. But that didn't obscure the fact that the kitschy Italian joint with checkered tablecloths served up the best New York strip in the city. I liked the place because they knew me, but I liked the steak even better. When I pulled up to the valet, I saw Bosch standing outside the restaurant's front door by himself. He was at the smoking bench, but I knew he didn't smoke. After turning over the car keys, I walked over. I noticed he had an inch-thick file tucked under his arm. The discovery file, I assumed.
You're the first one here? I asked.
No, they're all in there, he said. Table in the back corner.
But you're here waiting for me. Is this where you asked me if I did it?
Give me a little more credit, Mick. If I thought you did it, I wouldn't have put up the money.
I nodded.
And nothing in that file changed your mind?
Not really. Just made me think you've got yourself in a pretty tight box.
Tell me about it. Should we go in?
Sure, but one thing before we're with the others. Like I said, somebody really put you in a box here, and I was thinking that you may want to run this thing out for as long as you can. You know, drop the speedy trial thing. Take your time with it.
So much for the vote of confidence.
It is what it is.
Thanks for the advice, but I'll pass. One way or another, I want this thing done.
I get it.
What about you? You okay? Still taking your pills?
Every day. So far, so good.
I like hearing that. And Maddie, how's she doing?
She's good. In the academy.
Man, the second generation. Just like the first.
I thought Haley wants to be a prosecutor.
She'll change her mind.
I smiled at him.
Let's go in.
One other thing. I just wanted to explain why I never came to see you in the jail.
I don't think you need to, Harry. Don't worry about it.
I should have visited, I know. But I didn't want to see you in there.
I know. Lorna told me. To be honest, I didn't even put you on my list. I didn't want you to see me in there either.
He nodded, and we went inside. Christian, the tuxedo-clad maitre d', greeted me warmly, and had the class not to mention that I hadn't been in there in more than 6 weeks, even though he probably knew why. I introduced Bosch as my brother. Christian escorted us to the table where the others were waiting, Jennifer, Lorna, and Cisco. It was a table for six, but with Cisco in the mix, it was crowded.
The smell of food on the tables around us was almost overpowering. I was distracted by it, and found myself turning and craning my neck to see what other patrons had ordered.
"You all right, boss?" Sisko asked.
I turned back to him. "Fine, I'm fine," I said. "But let's order first. Where's Arturo?" Lorna waved to someone behind me, and soon Arturo was at our table with his order pad. It was orders of Steak Helen all around, except for Jennifer, who wasn't a red meat eater. She went with eggplant parmesan, on Arturo's recommendation. Lorna ordered a bottle of red wine for the drinkers, and I asked for a big bottle of sparkling water. I also told Arturo to bring bread and butter as soon as he could. "Okay," I said when we were alone. "Tonight, we can celebrate because I'm free and we knocked the prosecution down a notch or two in court, but that's it. No hangovers tomorrow because we go back to work." Everybody nodded except Bosch. He just stared at me from the opposite side of the table. "Harry, you're dying to say something," I said. "Probably something bad. You want to start? You have the discovery file. Did you read it?"
Sure, he said. "I read the discovery, and I also talked to some people I know."
"Like who?" Jennifer asked. Bosch looked at her for a moment. I raised my hand a few inches off the table as a signal for her to cool it. Bosch was long retired from the LAPD, but he was still tightly connected. I knew that firsthand and did not need him to name his sources.
"What did they tell you?" I asked.
"Well, they're pretty pissed off over at the DA's office because of the way you sandbagged Berg," Bosch said.
"They get caught cheating, and they're pissed at us?" Jennifer said. "That's just beautiful."
"What's the upshot?" I said. "What are they going to do about it?"
"For one, they're going to go after special circumstances like it's the Holy Grail," Bosch said. "They want to punish you for that stunt today. Put you back in jail."
"That's bullshit," Sisko said.
"Yeah, but they can do it," Bosch said, "if they find the evidence."
"There is no evidence," Jennifer asked. "Financial gain? Murder for hire? It's ridiculous."
"All I'm saying is they're looking," Bosch said, staring at me, as though the others at the table didn't count. "And you have to be careful with your own moves."
"I don't understand," Lorna said.
"You raised hell about car and phone data," Bosch said. "I assume you need it to prove you never left your house. That might just end up being evidence supporting that you paid somebody to grab Scales and bring him to you. That gets you close to murder for hire."
"Like I said, bullshit," Sisko said.
"I'm saying this is how they're thinking," Bosch said. "It's how I would think."
"Sam owed me money," I said. "Never paid me the back end on the last case, and we sued him. What was it, Lorna? 60K?
75, Lorna said. "With interest and penalty, it's over 100 now. But we did it just to get a judgment and lien. We knew he'd never pay."
"Still, they could point to that. Make it look like murder for financial gain," I said. "If they could prove Sam had money, the lien would carry over in death."
"Did he?" Bosch asked. "Have money? They have a news clip that says he ripped off $10 million through all his cons. Where'd it go?"
"I remember that article," I said. "The most hated man in America, they called him. It was exaggerated and didn't make me any friends, especially at home. But Sam was always on the con. He always had money coming in. It went somewhere."
"But this is crazy," Jennifer said. "They think you would kill a former client for an unpaid bill? For $75,000? $100,000?"
"No, they don't think that," I said. "That's not the point. The point is, they're pissed. And if they can push this into special circumstances, my bail is pulled and I go back to Twin Towers. That's what they want, to fuck me over, to tilt the table their way. Doesn't matter if the added charge doesn't hold up later in court." Jennifer shook her head.
"It still makes no sense," she said. "I think your sources are crap."
She looked pointedly at Bosch. He was the new guy, the outsider, and was suspect in her eyes. I tried to push past the moment.
Okay, so how long do I have before they pull this shit? I asked.
They have to find the money and prove you knew about it, Bosch said. If they get there, they'll drop the current charges and go back to the grand jury. Then they refile with special circumstances.
That will restart the speedy trial clock and mean the money posted today for bond goes down the toilet, Jennifer said. You go to jail, the bond is forfeited.
That's bullshit, Sisko said again.
Okay, well, we should be ready to go in to see Warfield the minute this all breaks, I said. Harry, you let us know what you hear when you hear it. Jennifer, we'll need an argument. There's subverting speedy trial, maybe vindictive prosecution, something.
I'm on it, Jennifer said. This makes me so fucking mad.
Don't let your emotions into it, I cautioned. Let's not go in mad. Let's make the judge mad.
I saw some of that today when we played the tape. I know it took her back to when she was a defense attorney. If the DA is doing this just to fuck with me, then Warfield will see it before we say it.
Both Jennifer and Bosch responded with nods.
Fucking cowards, Sisko said. Afraid to go straight up with you, boss.
I liked that my team seemed angrier about the prosecution's end run than I was. It would help keep them sharp in the days and weeks running up to trial. I returned my attention to Bosch. I realized more than the others what an incredibly good break it was to have him in our court. I had taken his side the year before, and now he was taking mine. But the moral support paled in comparison with what he brought as an investigator.
Harry, did you ever work with Drucker and Lopez? I asked.
Kent Drucker and Rafael Lopez were the LAPD leads on the case. They worked out of the elite robbery homicide division, where Bosch had worked until the end of his LAPD career.
Never directly on a case, Bosch said. They were in the squad, but there wasn't a lot of crossover on things. They were good detectives, though. You don't get to RHD if you're not. The question becomes, what do you do when you get there? Rest on your laurels or keep chopping wood? The fact that they were assigned this case answers that one.
I nodded. Bosch looked hesitant. I wondered whether he'd heard more. Something he didn't realize was valuable or was holding back until he could fill it out.
What?
I asked. You have something else?
Sort of, he said.
Might as well get it out so we can discuss it, I said.
Well, one of my last cases at RHD, I had an investigation where there was a financial fraud involved, Bosch said. A guy was embezzling funds, got found out, killed the guy who found out to shut him up. Pretty clean, but we couldn't find the money. His lifestyle showed nothing. He wasn't spending it, he was hiding it. So we hired a financial forensics analyst to follow the money, help us find it.
Okay, I said. Did it work?
Yeah. We found the money offshore and made the case, Bosch said. I bring it up now because my partner from back then is still on the job in RHD. She told me that Drucker came to her and asked her for the contact info for the financial forensics guy.
We should look into getting our own, Jennifer added. She wrote a note down on a small pad on the table in front of her.
Let's look again through our files on Sam's past cases, I said. Maybe there's something in them with info on how he moved and hid cash. Harry, anything else?
I looked over my shoulder for Arturo. It wasn't that I was starving, but I couldn't wait to have a real meal for the first time in 6 weeks.
Just on the discovery file, Bosch said. I've been through the photos and the autopsy. It was all pretty self-explanatory. No surprises. But then I saw this.
He was looking through his copy of the discovery and pulled out two documents and a crime scene photo. He handed them around the table and waited a moment until everyone had a look and they came back to him.
The autopsy report stated that the victim's fingernails were scraped
for samples of what looked like dirt or grease, he said. Then, the lab report came in, identifying the substance as a combination of vegetable oil, chicken fat, and some sugar cane. Cooking grease, according to the report.
I saw that in the discovery, I said. Why is it significant?
Well, when you look at the crime scene photos, you see that all of this guy's fingernails were dirty with this stuff, Bosch said.
I'm still not following, I said. If it was blood or something, I could...
I looked at this guy's rap sheet, Bosch interjected. He was strictly white-collar cons, internet mostly. And now, he's got grease under his nails.
So what does it mean? I pressed.
Maybe he was working as a fucking dishwasher, Sisko said.
I think it means he was into something completely new, Bosch said. What that means to the case, I don't know. But I think you should request a sample of the fingernail grease for your own testing.
Okay, I said. We can do that, Jennifer.
Got it,
she said.
She wrote it down. I was about to pass the baton to Lorna to see what she had come up with on the review of my past cases. But Arturo brought the steaks to the table at that moment, and I kept my mouth closed until we were all served. I then started devouring my strip like a man who has eaten only apples and bologna sandwiches for a month and a half. I soon became aware that I was being watched by the others. I spoke without looking up at them.
What? You never seen a guy eat a steak before? I asked.
Just never seen one eat it so fast, Lorna replied.
Well, stand back. I might order another, I said. I need to get back to my fighting weight.
Since you take so much time between bites, Lorna, why don't you tell us where we stand on my enemies list?
Before she could answer, I glanced over at Bosch to offer an explanation.
Lorna has been going through the old case files and drawing up a list of enemies, people who might have wanted to do this to me, I said. Lorna?
Well, the list so far is short, Lorna said. You've had your problem clients, and there have been some threats, but very few who we think have the skills, smarts, and general wherewithal to pull together a frame like this.
It's a sophisticated frame, Sisko added. Your run-of-the-mill client could not do this.
So who could? I asked. Who's on your list?
I've been through everything twice and came up with only one name, Lorna said.
One name? I said. That's it? Who?
Louis Aparicio, she said.
Wait, what? I said. Louis Aparicio?
The name rang a loud bell in my memory, but I needed a moment to place it. I was sure I'd never had a client named Louis Aparicio.
Then I remembered. Aparicio wasn't a client. He was a witness. A man from a mob-connected family who straddled the line between criminal enterprise and legitimate business. I had used him. I had cornered him on the witness stand and made him look like the guilty party. It drew the jury's attention away from my client and on to Aparicio. Compared to him, my client looked like an angel. I remembered an encounter I'd had with Aparicio in a courthouse restroom. I remembered the anger, the hate. He was a bull of a man, built like a fireplug, and his arms hung away from his body like he was ready to use them to tear me apart. He'd backed me into a corner and had wanted to kill me right there.
Who is Aparicio? Bosch asked.
He's somebody I pinned a murder on once in court, I said.
He was mobbed up, Sisko added, from Vegas.
And did he do it? Bosch asked.
No, but I made it look like he did, I said. My client got the NG and walked.
And was your client really guilty?
I hesitated, but then answered truthfully.
Yes, but I didn't know it at the time.
Bosch nodded. And I took it as a judgment, as though I had just confirmed why people hate lawyers.
So, he said then, would Aparicio, wanting to return the favor and pin a murder on you, be out of the question?
No, not at all,
I said. What happened in court back then? It caused him a lot of problems and cost him a lot of money. He was a sleeper. He was trying to move mob money into legitimate fields, and I sort of blew that up when I had him on the stand. Bosch thought about that for a few moments, and nobody interrupted. Okay, he finally said. Let me take Aparicio, find out what he's up to. And Cisco, you stay with Sam Scales. Maybe we cross paths somewhere, and then we know why this whole thing went down. It sounded like a plan to me, but I was going to let Cisco decide. It seemed we were all looking at him, waiting, when he nodded his approval. Okay, he said. Let's do it. Chapter 14. I got home late and parked on the street. I didn't want to park in the garage and wasn't sure I ever would again. I entered to find the house completely dark. In that moment, I thought Kendall was gone, that she had realized, now that I was out, that she didn't want to live here with me again. But then I saw movement in the darkened hallway, and she appeared. She was wearing just a robe. You're home, she said. Yeah, it went late, I said. A lot to discuss. You've been waiting in the dark? Actually, I've been asleep since earlier. We never turned on any lights when we got here. We just went straight to the bed. I nodded that I understood. My eyes started adjusting to the shadows and the dark. So you didn't eat? I said. You must be hungry. No, I'm fine, she said. You must be tired. Sort of, yeah. But still excited about being free? Yeah. I had woken that day in a jail cell. I was now about to sleep in my own bed for the first time in 6 weeks, my back on a thick mattress and my head on a soft pillow. And if that wasn't enough, my ex-girlfriend had come back and was standing in front of me with her robe open and nothing on underneath. I was still accused of murder, but it was amazing how my fortunes had changed in a single day. As I stood there, I felt that nobody could ever touch me. I was golden. I was free. Well, Kendall said, smiling, I hope not too tired. I think I can manage, I said. She turned and disappeared into the darkness of the hallway leading to the bedroom, and I followed. Part 2. Follow the Honey. Chapter 15. Thursday, January 9th. I had no illusions about my innocence. I knew it was something only I could know for sure. And I knew that it wasn't a perfect shield against injustice. It was no guarantee of anything. The clouds were not going to open for some sort of divine light of intervention. I was on my own. Innocence is not a legal term. No one is ever found innocent in a court of law. No one is ever exonerated by the verdict of a jury. The justice system can only deliver a verdict of guilty or not guilty. Nothing else, nothing more. The law of innocence is unwritten. It will not be found in a leather-bound code book. It will never be argued in a courtroom. It cannot be written into law by the elected. It is an abstract idea, and yet it closely aligns with the hard laws of nature and science. In the law of physics, for every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. In the law of innocence, for every man not guilty of a crime, there is a man out there who is. And to prove true innocence, the guilty man must be found and exposed to the world. That was my plan. To go further than a jury verdict, to expose the guilty and make my innocence clear. It was my only way out. To that end, December proceeded with preparations for trial as well as prep for the anticipated move by the prosecution to recharge me and remand me back to a solo cell at Twin Towers. As the days until Christmas counted down,
my paranoia rose incrementally. I expected the cruelest of moves by Death Row Dana as payback for the humiliation I had brought her in the last hearing. A Christmas Day arrest, with courts closed for the holidays, and me left unable to put our ready arguments before Judge Warfield until the calendar turned to the new year. There was no evasive action that I could take. My current bail restriction forbade me to leave the county, and the ankle-mounted monitor broadcast my location to authorities 24 hours a day. If they wanted me, they could surely find me. There was no escape. But no one came knocking. No one came looking for me. I spent Christmas Eve with my daughter, and she went to her mother's on Christmas Day. And I got an early dinner with her a week later before she went off with friends to celebrate the changing of the year. Kendall was with me the whole time, and even told me on New Year's Eve that she was having all her belongings shipped back from Hawaii. All in all, it was a great month of freedom and work in preparation for the trial that lay ahead of me. But it would have been better if I hadn't been looking over my shoulder the whole time. I began to think that I had been played, that Harry Bosch had been fed the false narrative of my rearrest as the real payback. Dana Berg had made sure I would not be able to rest easy in my newfound freedom. And so, she had the last laugh. As far as the investigation into eavesdropping on privileged conversations at Twin Towers, that Judge Warfield had promised, Berg escaped unscathed. The illegal activity was laid squarely at the door of the jail intelligence unit. A report that was leaked to the Los Angeles Times during the news-starved week after Christmas resulted in a New Year's Day exclusive on the front page that concluded that deputies had been listening for years to privileged conversations, the contents of which were then used to create tip sheets from non-existent jailhouse informants. These were then turned over to police and prosecutors. It was one more black eye for the sheriff's jail division, which in the prior decade had been the target of multiple federal investigations. Horror stories had abounded of jail deputies staging gladiator fights, putting inmates in cells with enemies, using gang members to carry out punishment beatings and rapes of other prisoners. Indictments had come and heads had rolled. The elected sheriff at the time and his second in command had even gone to prison for turning a blind eye to the corruption. Now, the eavesdropping scandal promised more scrutiny and disgrace. Most likely, the feds would be back in play, and the new year was sure to bring a free-for-all for defense attorneys looking to overturn convictions in cases affected by the illegal activity. This caused me to double down on my resolve not to be returned to Twin Towers. Every deputy in the jail would know that the latest scandal that had befallen them was caused by me. I could clearly imagine the retribution that would be awaiting me if I went back. I finally got a call from Harry Bosch. I had not heard from him since well before Christmas, despite leaving messages of holiday greetings and requests for updates on his part of the investigation. I knew that nothing had happened to him. My daughter had reported seeing him at his house when she visited her cousin Maddie over the break. And now, finally, he called. He appeared not to be aware of my efforts to contact him over the past weeks. He simply said he had something he wanted me to see. I was still at home, having a second cup of coffee with Kendall, and he agreed to swing by and pick me up. We drove south in his old Jeep Cherokee, the one with the squared-off design and the 25-year-old suspension. Shake, rattle, and roll. The car shook every time its tires hit a seam in the asphalt, rattled with every pothole, and threatened to roll on every left turn as the aging springs compressed and the car tilted to the right. He kept KNX News on and had the uncanny ability to engage in conversation while still keeping an ear on the radio and from time to time throwing comments on the news of the day into the conversation. Even when I turned the volume knob down to respond, he would then turn it back up. "So," I said, once we were down out of the hills, "where are we going?"
It's something I want you to see first, Bosch said. It's about Aparicio, I hope. I mean, you were working on him, and then you disappear for like a month. I didn't disappear. I was working the case. I told you you'd hear from me when I had something, and now I think I do. Well, I hope it's a connection to Sam Scales and the case. Otherwise, you've been chasing a pipe dream. You'll know soon enough. Can you at least tell me how far we're going, so I can tell Lorna when I'll be back? T.I. What? They're not going to let me in with this thing on my ankle. We're not going to the prison. I just want to show you something. And a photo wouldn't do? I don't think so. We drove in silence for a while after that. Bosch took the 101 south into downtown, and then jumped onto the 110, which would be a straight shot down to Terminal Island at the Port of Los Angeles. There was nothing awkward or uncomfortable about the stall and the conversation. We were half-brothers and comfortable with the silences. Bosch listened to the news, and I tuned it out with thoughts about the case. We were going to trial in under 6 weeks, and I still had no grounds for a defense. Bosch may have gone silent, but at least he had something he wanted me to see. My other investigator, Cisco, had been staying in close contact, but his efforts to background Sam Scales had so far been fruitless. I figured I was a week away from doing the unthinkable, throwing aside my right to a speedy trial and asking for time, for a continuance. But I worried that such a request would reveal too much. It would show desperation, panic, and maybe even signal guilt. I would be acting like someone delaying the inevitable. Where the hell is Wuhan? Bosch said. His words rescued me from the downward spiral of my thoughts. Who? I asked. He pointed to the radio. Not who, he said. It's a place, somewhere in China. Were you listening? No, I was thinking, I said. What was it? They've got a mystery virus over there, killing people. Well, at least it's there and not here. Yeah, for how long? You ever been over there, China? Just to Hong Kong. Oh, right, Maddie's mom. Sorry I brought it up. Long time ago. I attempted to change the subject. So, what's Aparicio like? I asked. What do you mean? Bosch responded. Well, I just remember, when I had him on the stand 9 years ago, he was restrained at first, but then out came the animal. He wanted to jump out of that chair and tear my throat out or something. He seemed more Tony Soprano than Michael Corleone, if you know what I mean. Well, so far I haven't laid eyes on the guy. That's not what I've been doing. I looked out the window and tried to blunt my shock and upset. I then turned back to engage. Harry, then what have you been doing? I asked. You had Aparicio, remember? You should have... Hold on, hold on, he said. I know I have Aparicio, but it wasn't about putting eyes on him. This isn't a surveillance job. It's about finding out what he was doing and whether or not it somehow connects to Scales and you. And that's what I've been doing. Okay, then stop with the whole mystery trip thing. Where are we going? Just take it easy. We're almost there, and then you'll be enlightened. Really? Enlightened? Like divine intervention or something? Not quite, but I think you'll like it. He was right about one thing. We were almost there. I looked around to get my bearings and saw that we had crossed the 405 and were just a few miles from the end of the harbor freeway at Terminal Island. Through the windshield and to the left, I could see the giant gantry cranes that loaded containers on and off cargo ships. We were in San Pedro now. Once a small fishing village, it was now part of the giant Port of Los Angeles complex, serving as a bedroom community for many of those who worked on the docks and in the shipping and oil industries. It had once had a full courthouse where I appeared regularly on behalf of clients accused of crimes. But the justice complex was shuttered by the county in a cost-cutting move, and the cases moved up to a courthouse by the airport. The San Pedro courthouse had now stood abandoned for well over a decade. I used to come down to Pedro a lot on cases, I said. I used to come down when I was a teenager, Bosch said. Sneak out of whatever place they put me, come down to the docks. I got tattooed down here once. I just nodded. It looked like he was reliving the memory, and I didn't want to intrude. I knew very little about Bosch's early life beyond what I had read once in an unauthorized profile in the Times. I remember foster homes and an early enlistment in the army with Vietnam as the destination. This was decades before we learned of our blood connection. We crossed the Vincent Thomas, the tall green suicide bridge that connected to Terminal Island. The entire island was dedicated to port and industrial operations, with the exception of the federal prison at the far end. Bosch exited the freeway and used surface streets to get us moving along the northern edge of the island and next to one of the deep port channels. Taking a wild guess, I said, Aparicio has some kind of smuggling operation here, stuff coming in on cargo containers, drugs, humans, what? Not that I know of, Bosch said. I'm going to show you something else. You see this area? He pointed through the windshield toward a vast parking lot filled with plastic-wrapped cars fresh off the boats from Japan. There used to be a Ford motor plant here, Bosch said. It was called Long Beach Assembly, and they made the Model A. My mother's father supposedly worked there in the 30s on the Model A line. What was he like? I asked. I never met him, only heard this story. And now it's Toyota's. I gestured toward the vast parking lot of new cars, ready to be disseminated to dealers across the West. Bosch turned onto a crushed shell road that ran alongside a rock jetty lining the channel. A black and white oil tanker the length of a football field, including the end zones, was slowly making its way down the channel to the port. Bosch pulled to a stop by what looked like an abandoned railroad spur and killed the engine. Let's walk up to the jetty, he said. I'll show you what we've got as soon as this tanker goes by. We followed an uphill walk to the top of a berm that ran behind the jetty as a barrier against high tides. By standing on top of it, we got a solid view across the channel of the various petroleum refining and storage facilities vital to the operations of the port. Okay, so this is the Cerritos Channel right here, and we are looking north, Bosch said. That's Wilmington, directly across the water, and Long Beach to the right. Okay, I said. What exactly are we looking at? The center of the California oil business. You've got the Marathon, Valero, Tesoro refineries right there. Chevron is farther up. The oil comes in here from all over, even Alaska. Comes to port by supertanker, barge, rail, pipeline, you name it. Then it goes over there to the refineries, and it gets processed from there into distribution, into tanker trucks and out to your local gas station, and then into your own gas tank. What's it all got to do with the case? Maybe nothing. Maybe everything. You see that refinery at the end there with the catwalks around the tanks? He pointed to the right, and at the small refinery, with a single stack billowing a white plume of smoke into the sky. An American flag was draped around the upper section of the stack. There were two side-by-side storage tanks that looked to be at least four stories tall and were surrounded by multiple catwalks. I see it, I said. That's BioGreen Industries, Bosch said. You won't find Louis Aparicio's name attached to any of the ownership documents, but he holds the controlling interest in BioGreen. No doubt about it. Bosch had my undivided attention now. How did you find that out? I asked. I followed the honey, Bosch said. What's that mean? Well, 9 years ago, you were able to drag Aparicio through the legal wood chipper at the trial for your client Lisa Trammell. I pulled the transcript and read his testimony. You don't have to tell me. I was there, remember? Another tanker was coming down the channel. It was so wide, it had little margin for error as it navigated between the jagged rocks that lined both sides. I know you were there, Bosch said, but what you might not know
is that Louis Aparicio learned a lot from getting pounded by you that day on the stand. Number one, he learned never again to be connected by legal documentation to any of his companies, legit or not. He currently owns nothing in his name and is connected to no company, board, or reported investment to anything. He uses people as fronts.
I'm damn proud I was able to teach him how to be a better criminal. How did you get around it?
The internet is still a pretty useful tool. Social media, newspaper archives. Aparicio's father died 4 years ago. There was a service in New Jersey and a virtual visitation book. Friends and family signed in, and damn if the funeral home's website doesn't still have it online.
More like hot damn, you got lots of names.
Names and connections. I started tracing, looking for stuff out here. Three Aparicio associates are vested owners of BioGreen and comprise a majority interest. He controls it through them. One of them is named Jeannie Farino, who in the last 7 years has risen from a Vegas stripper with a couple of possession pops on her record to part owner of a variety of businesses from there to here and back again. I think Jeannie is Aparicio's side piece.
Follow the honey.
Right to BioGreen.
This is getting good, Bosch.
I pointed down the channel to the refinery. But if Aparicio has a secret ownership in businesses from here to Vegas, why are we looking at this one?
Because this is where the biggest money is.
You see that place? It's not a typical refinery. It's a biodiesel plant. Basically, it makes fuel from plants and animal fat. It's recycling waste into an alternate fuel that costs less and burns cleaner. And right now, it's the apple of the government's eye because it reduces our national dependence on oil. It's the future, and Louis Aparicio is riding the wave. The government is propping this business up, paying companies like BioGreen a premium on each barrel just to make it. That's on top of what they get for then going out and selling that barrel. And where there's government subsidy, there is always corruption. You got that right. I started pacing along the worn footpath on top of the berm. I was trying to see the connections and how this could all work.
So there's a guy, Bosch said, a lieutenant who runs the bureau at Harbor Division. I trained him 25 years ago. When he came through Hollywood Detectives as a D1.
Can you talk to him? I asked.
Already did. He knows I'm retired, so I told him I was fishing around for a friend who was interested in BioGreen as an investment. I wanted to know if there were any red flags.